This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for tuning in. Ahead this hour, living through the pandemic as an Asian American, many are experiencing acts of discrimination and even hatred. We'll hear more from Ann Ishii of the Mayor's Commission for Asian American Affairs. Also, pitchers might be idle, but Major League Baseball is hoping to throw COVID-19 a curveball. The MLB is taking part in a massive study designed to help get America back to work. But to begin, as the coronavirus pandemic continues, colleges and college students are scrambling to figure out the next step. Classes were, of course, upended and transformed as students across the nation were sent home and distance learning was set up. But the cost to many institutions of higher learning has been extraordinarily high. In Pennsylvania, losses for the state's 14 public universities and colleges could reach as much as $100 million. And as lawmakers grapple with the specter of a potential state budget gap totaling billions, some are calling for mergers in the state university system and possibly even closures. Jillian McGoldrick has been reporting on this for Lancaster Online and Spotlight PA and joins us now with more. Hello, Jillian.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. So as you report, the damage the pandemic has inflicted on the state system of colleges and universities could range in the many millions of dollars. Where is much of the money being lost?
So they're looking at a $70 million to $100 million gap just for the spring semester that they lost. And that's mainly from room and board refunds that they returned to students as they had to pack their bags and go home once the coronavirus began to spread in Pennsylvania.
Also, even before this happened, fewer students had been applying.
Yes, the enrollment has been slowly trickling down. It was about 105,000 in 2010, and slowly but surely thousands of students have, the state system has been losing students, and even more so, they have projected that high school graduation rates will continue to decline. So they were already in the middle of a system redesign to prepare for a declining enrollment.
So COVID-19, in effect, was part of part two of a double whammy because the system was facing some financial challenges before the pandemic. Jillian, what are lawmakers saying might have to happen here?
So Senator Scott Martin, who is a Republican senator in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, he is floating the idea that mergers will need to be looked at minimum, and even worse, in a worst case scenario, they'll possibly have to close some of the schools or at least one school. But that's what Dan Greenstein, who's the chancellor of PASHE, says, that it would be overly costly to the taxpayer to close these schools, that it would be much better to keep these open or repurpose them and reimagine how they can be used.
So back to State Senator Scott Martin for just a moment. Was he specific about where mergers might happen or even, you know, the possibility of a closure?
He was not specific. There are obviously some schools that are struggling much more than others, namely Cheney University, which is the nation's first historically Black university. It had only about 620 students this year, which is a 61% decrease since its 2010 numbers.
Hmm. And as you report, Jillian, there's Cheney. Also, there were the schools which suffered the most include Clarion, Edinburgh, Lock Haven, and Mansfield University. But again, Cheney seems to be in the most serious situation. Governor Wolf, at some point, had promised to help keep the doors open at Cheney.
Yes, he promised to make sure that the $40 million that it owed in 2019 to the state system, that debt would be paid. And then, of course, as other schools, they have also had extreme declines in enrollment, including like 45% for Edinburgh. All of those schools are upwards of 30% declines in enrollment since 2010.
Hmm. Fair to say these schools are a lifeline for the communities in which they are located. Tell us more about that, Jillian.
Absolutely. So these schools are all over the state in all sorts of different areas. Like you can see Westchester in Westchester, or Cheney in Delco. You can see that they are main employers to these areas, and they provide a lot more than just like existing or for students coming in and coming out. They are cornerstones for their communities. Like with some students that I spoke with, they go out into their community and were visiting in nursing homes before the coronavirus pandemic, doing some service learning, or they are the top employers in the area with people like you think more than just professors, so yeah. Janitors or mechanics. And that's another area that's also been additionally hit. One of my colleagues at Lancaster Online, Alex Gli, reported that at least 700 non-faculty employees, which would be those janitors, mechanics, food service employees, that they all have been placed on unpaid leave and means that they are forced to use their paid time off if they want to collect a paycheck during this time. That's at all of these 14 universities owned by the state.
Yeah, there's been a terrible ripple effect, obviously. Governor Wolf had asked for a scholarship fund for low and middle income students who attended colleges and universities in the state system. That's in this year's state budget proposal, which was crafted before the impact of the pandemic. Jillian, do we know where this stands?
Yes. In a call last week, Governor Wolf said that he still does plan to pursue the policy and budget items that he had originally introduced in February of this year prior to the pandemic, including this program and repurposing a controversial horse racing fund that of $250 million to create this scholarship fund for low and middle income students in the state system.
Okay. And before we move on, just one more note about Cheney. We'd spoken about Governor Wolf's promise to help keep the doors open there. Any word as to whether this promise can be kept?
I do not have the answer to that.
Okay. Well, there's probably no word at this point. I didn't know if you had that information at your fingertips.
For sure. They still have no idea exactly what they're going to have to do and what they're going to have to restructure at this time, but they said that it's going to happen much faster than it was going to before because of the financial losses that they are already experiencing and expect to continue to experience in the future.
Okay, so much remains uncertain. Let's get to the Systems Board of Governors. What power does the board have, if any, to influence mergers or closures, Jillian?
Right now, the Board of Governors, really their main job is to appoint presidents, like they just appointed an interim president to East Stroudsburg last week. They also are the main, they set tuition rates, and that's sort of their main powers. And right now they are working on this redesign that they'll present to the legislature, but they are asking for some regulatory relief through some legislation that would allow them to actually close schools if necessary, or merge schools, because right now they don't have that power.
Do you know if lawmakers are open to expanding the reach of the Board of Governors?
I believe that they are, yes.
Okay. Tuition, has been relatively affordable, about $8,000 a year for 4 years at the state colleges and universities. But it has been on the rise recently. Is that the case?
Yes. Like all tuition across the country, tuition is rising, cost of enrollment is rising. It is much more affordable than even Pennsylvania state-related universities like Pitt, Penn State, Temple, Lincoln. That Temple, I know, is about like $17,000 a year, when a state system school is about $8,000 a year as base tuition. So there's definitely a big gap but it still has slowly been ticking up like the rest of tuition.
Well, I know some universities are tweaking the tuition because classes are online and students are saying, you know, this is not the same as being in a classroom. We shouldn't be paying as much. Penn State apparently is will adjust tuition to reflect change pending approval from the Board of Trustees there. An undergrad at University Park or Altoona, who's from Pennsylvania, will pay about $200 less per credit moving forward, at least through the summer. Do you have this information? How is Chancellor Greenstein approaching this situation, the question of tuition?
They were very quick to refund students who are living on campus. I don't believe that they are considering, and to my knowledge, they are not considering any tuition refunds for the change in how instruction is given during this time.
Okay. And, you know, aside from all this, and this has happened before the pandemic, apparently, there's been a huge change within the system itself. Colleges and universities in the state system, apparently starting this year, will be able to set their own tuition rates beginning with the fall semester. Considering everything that has happened, is there now a second look being taken at this ability to set tuition rates?
The Board of Governors was supposed to set their the base tuition rate on April 1st. So here we are, it's April 20th, and they are still calculating how much the system will lose into the summer and the fall. They're even still considering whether or not they'll be back on campus in the fall. So since there is so much unknown, I believe that is another unknown. Whether or not the system schools will be able to set their own tuition at this time.
Dan Greenstein was appointed chancellor 2 years ago, and at the time, 2 years ago, he began to implement some cost-cutting measures. Tell us about what he's done.
Yeah, most recently, he has put an entire cap on hiring new faculty. There's been a new program for faculty who are retiring to incentivize some faculty to leave the state system that gives them a way to pay out some of their days that would be especially enticing to a faculty member. And he also is looking for each school to see where they have gaps in enrollment in specific programs, see whether or not they can repurpose that program or use other schools across the system for some sort of cross education so that a student at Westchester may be able to take an online class for a nursing class at IUP in Indiana, Pennsylvania.
Okay. We only have about 10 seconds, Jillian. Is there any sense as to when Mr. Goldstein might start to implement some of these changes?
They'll have to act fast. I think by the fall, there will be some decisions made.
All right, Jillian McGoldrick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jillian is state and federal government reporter for Lancaster Online and reports for Spotlight PA as well. Up next on the Radio Times Regional Roundup, we talk about discrimination against Asian Americans during the time of the coronavirus. Stick around.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. No doubt these are challenging times for many, if not most of us. But in addition to this, imagine having your fellow Americans turn against you because of your heritage. Many Asian Americans say they are experiencing discrimination and even hate due to the misconception that they are somehow responsible for the coronavirus. According to the Anti-Defamation League, there have been numerous reports of harassment against individuals of Asian or Pacific Islander descent, including physical assaults, racial slurs, being spat on. State and local governments are calling on citizens to remain vigilant against discrimination. The Pennsylvania State Police Department, for instance, says it is committed to preventing and investigating hate or bias crime. But What more can be done? If you'd like to comment or you have a question, our email is radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Anne Ishii joins us now on Radio Times. Anne is head of the Asian Arts Initiative in Philadelphia, and she sits on the Mayor's Commission for Asian American Affairs. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, boy, it's tough to know where to begin, except perhaps to ask Anne on a personal level, how might this be impacting you as an American of Asian descent?
Sure. You know, for starters, I have to say that while we understand that there is a true medical emergency throughout the world, that the, you know, spiritual crisis that this implicates in the Asian American community is not to be overlooked either. And that is also a medical and can become an even greater medical situation. And what I mean by that is just simply that as anxiety becomes a secondary epidemic here, you know, the Asian American community and the Asian diaspora at large has historically had a very difficult time parsing and sort of coming to terms with its mental health issues. This is just going to, you know, paint us further into a hole that's harder to come out of when, you know, if we ever get back into, I guess, normal society. And, you know, these issues, we already had a historically in the community a hard time talking about it, you know, when the particular conflicts that we're facing right now are, you know, the so-called outcomes that the racialized attacks seek are for us to stay further and further in hiding. I'm just really scared for our community that it'll just make us it'll just retract a lot of hard-won confidence and courage to come out and talk about how we're feeling.
Mm. Well, yourself on a personal level, I mean, what does it do to a person to be, you know, say, if somebody hurls a racial slur in your direction, unfairly targeting you or another person of Asian American, Asian descent because of this virus?
Yeah, I mean, all. You know, to be honest, myself and a lot of people I know, we're really depending on people who maybe don't present as Asian, or even if we're in households with non-Asian people, that they, you know, our preference is, for example, in my own home, my husband, who's Italian-American, does all of the outdoor grocery shopping because I just literally don't want to be in a space where I'm inviting any kind of interaction. I have friends who are walking their dogs at 2 a.m. to avoid even the very little interaction that they might face on the street currently, as a Korean American. And then, you know, just the fear, you know, how many times have you been in a really strange interaction with a stranger and wished you'd come up with the right thing to say at the moment and have been lost for words until, you know, a day or a month later? Compound that with the fact that so many people don't have fluency in English, for example. I'm hearing about people for whom English is a second or third language, you know, just the incredible frustration with not being able to fight back or speak out, you know, in the moment. That's hard enough as it is if you're fluent in the language. It's much harder when it's not your first language.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. The Commission for Asian American Affairs and said in a statement that basically it's very difficult for many people to report incidents of verbal abuse, yeah, humiliation, defacing of property to authorities. Tell us, yeah, why there's such reluctance to talk about what's happening.
You know, I mean, this, we are not unfamiliar with institutionalized racism, right? There have been so many acts of sort of bias at the level of the state historically. So there's a natural distrust, I think, of both sort of administrative mechanisms, from the Exclusion Act to the internment of the Japanese Americans to today, you know, with ICE rates preceding this and probably ongoing, in terms of, you know, containing the community and the communities for various reasons. So there's already sort of this distrust. You know, this is a census year. Historically, Asian Americans have been the least likely to report an accurate health makeup. there just hasn't been a very good record of relationship of information communication. So, I think just on top of all of that, why would anybody report something that feels like it's your fault? I mean, if it feels like, I think a lot of this is internalized in our communities because we're starting to believe that some of this might be true.
Really? That it is your, in quotation marks, fault?
No, well, not our fault, but just the way that this information has been sort of packaged, it came from China or it's been dealt with in Asia. And our own organization has seen the effects of this since as early as, let's say, December, because,
You're saying some really important things right now, but we're experiencing some breakup on the line. So why don't we hang up and we're going to redial and get you back again, because we don't want to miss what you're saying. Again, our guest is Ann Ishii. She is Executive Director of the Asian Arts Initiative. She also sits on the Mayor's Commission for Asian American Affairs in Philadelphia. We're talking about the very real pain that many people of Asian descent and people who happen to be from Asia who are in this country are experiencing being falsely blamed for the coronavirus. We'll talk about what is available to help. Many people, Anne was saying, are in the community are reluctant to report incidents of discrimination. And I believe, Anne, we have you back now?
Yep, I'm back on.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, well, I was just saying, I don't think anybody believes in the Asian community that they're, somehow a medical source of actual illness. It's just to do with the information that we're getting bombarded with makes us feel, and because we've been on the front line of the information for so long, even in our own organization, our constituents have been feeling the news and the pressure of the information since as early as, I'm going to say, December. Because we've had access to information coming directly out of China, and a lot of folks have felt like, really kind of almost dismissed by all of this, that maybe just owning all of this anxiety makes us feel like, we're really feeling it. I mean, it's sort of combating both the fear of the actual illness itself and the information about it.
Let's talk about the help that is out there. Is the Commission on Asian American Affairs actively reaching out to the community? And can there be some relief for people in terms of pursuing acts of, racial discrimination?
Yeah.
I mean, what's there for people if they have the ability to be able to report it?
Absolutely. I want to start by acknowledging all of the amazing groundwork being done by local Asian American organizations like Asian Americans United, Viet Lead, CMEC, PCDC. I'm certainly forgetting the name. I think a lot of this work has been in the community. So it's community leaders reminding everybody to be afraid, to speak up, to step up, to move forward. The commission has advertised in, the Office of Immigrant Affairs, which coexists with the Office of Human Relations in the city. So you can always go to the website or make a phone call to report any act of bias, any act. I mean, there's no threshold here. Anytime you're encountering, a hateful experience based on the fear of COVID. And, so those are actual things. There's always, obviously if you're the victim of a violent crime or crime in general, there's always 911, of course. Yeah. I also can't stress this enough. The more we tell these stories, the reporting can happen at an informal level. People just need to know that this is happening. There needs to be an awareness.
So they can speak up without fear of reprisal.
Exactly.
Okay. What would you like to hear more from our leaders, especially at the federal level? I mean, President Trump has called the coronavirus the Chinese virus. Do you see an immediate effect after rhetoric like this from him and perhaps, others who might be in positions of power.
Absolutely. I don't even know where to begin. I think if anybody can come up with a way to temper any of the rhetoric coming out of the administration, I think we'd all be grateful for some resources or advice. I truly don't even know where to begin, because it feels like my gosh, it's really difficult when right now, I mean, whatever sort of outcomes I'd like to see from the federal administration feel like fantasy at this point. To really watch what everybody's saying, certainly the president, I'd ask, it's really hard to talk about, the rhetoric. It's hard to contain that, or to ask somebody like him to contain it. But
because you see an effect.
Sorry?
Because there's an effect. I mean, do you see an increase
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there is an effect. The problem is, calling it the Chinese virus is obviously a problem. It's inaccurate. It's hateful. There's implications in there. The other thing is, and this is a little bit maybe more complex than it needs to be, but, by calling it that, it's also sort of, what is Chinese anyway, right? Like it's anybody who looks that way to the rest of America. And now we're into, this other form of bias, and it's the same problem after 9/11. And it's an existing problem with all of our, the cultural racisms in our country. I mean, I would hate, for example, for an Asian American to feel that they needed to distinguish that they are not Chinese in response to this. That doesn't feel like the right answer, but that is also part of what's happening. So if I'm Japanese, Korean American, if I'm being called, a racial epithet indicating I might be Chinese, I mean, part of me wants to clarify that I am not of that descent, but on the other hand, I'm also saying that that's wrong. I mean, why would that matter?
And we've got some questions and comments coming in. Kim asks, did your guest happen to see Joe Biden's anti-Chinese government ad over the weekend? Some consider it to be quite xenophobic. I have not seen it. Have you seen it?
I haven't. I've actually avoided watching it. I'm, I think like a lot of people, my screen time has just gone through the roof, and whatever I can do to mitigate sort of whatever's going to inflame my internecine ideas about the right thing to say right now, I just don't know. But what I'm understanding about this is, it's sort of playing to the people who are already speaking in that language. Again, it's really hard to know how to combat a culture of that language, getting even just the words that are being used.
You are head of the Asian Arts Initiative in Philadelphia, which, as I understand it, helps to present art which addresses the Asian American experience. Are you seeing coronavirus and discrimination reflected in art being created at the moment? Speaking of expression.
Yeah, sure. What's interesting, you should ask that. Our mission is to build community. So we are an arts organization, but we are primarily here to sort of call out what exists naturally in the neighborhood, in the city, in the region. And, right now we're feeling a little helpless with an empty building that can't be activated. We've covered it with posters through the Cover the Walls with Hope campaign. So a lot of people are creating messaging. They're designing and illustrating a lot of these beautiful posters, speaking out against hate rhetoric and, leaning into the social distancing, but hoping that we feel like there's a togetherness in that campaign. So there are literal intervention designs, posters and illustrations and digital campaigns that we're supporting 100%.
Do you anticipate at some point in the near future, on a personal level, not having your husband, who happens to be of Italian-American heritage, doing errands so that you don't have to go out?
I'm not not doing errands. I mean, I think my husband would be mortified if I never left the house. So, I mean, I guess the future I'm hopeful for is actually that all of us, you know, are going back into patronizing Chinatown businesses and each other, and that, you know, I'm very hopeful. I remain hopeful.
Well, Chinatown experienced a drastic drop in revenue just before the social distancing restrictions were put into place. How long do you think it'll take to restore the vibrancy of Chinatown? How long might this take? And we're talking, obviously, after restrictions are lifted.
Yeah, my gosh. I mean, I guess if I'm being realistic and thinking about other crises, 08, 9/11, years, I mean, again, I can't emphasize enough that this has been so dispiriting and just the emotional toll that it's taken. You know, the first thing that we eliminate when we're in this sort of a survival mode, I think, is culture. And I know we're all literally hungry for food and entertainment, but if Chinatown is representative of, you know, I'm very worried that this will take a very long time to bring back from. Even if the doors open, there's still going to be a, you know, a huge barrier of trust and fear we have to overcome.
And Ishii, how can art heal during times of hurt and anger?
Sorry?
How can art heal during times of hurt and anger? And we've got about 30 seconds.
How can the arts heal? Yeah, I think what we're doing right now is so amazing, actually, in light of all of this. There's so much deeper communication across more organizations. I'm talking to people I didn't think I'd ever be speaking with, leadership at the major art museums and, you know, funding organizations. I feel very strongly the outreach from everybody who has vested interest and concern for our community. So I think just, you know, a lot of this begins with just staying in touch with each other. And I think the arts have been a very isolating industry to begin with. The interesting side effect to all of this is that we are finally a community.
All right. Hey, Anne, we're going to ask you to stay with us a few more minutes to talk about this subject here on Radio Times, if you don't mind. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. Stick around.
Welcome. Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We've just got one more question for Anne Ishii, head of the Asian Arts Initiative in Philadelphia. Anne, thanks for sticking around. I was just curious, you know, if you were to observe an incident of racial harassment against a member of the Asian American community in regards to the coronavirus, what might you feel compelled to tell that person to educate them? Do we have Ann?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Were you able to hear the question?
Yeah, I don't know. That's hard. I think it depends on the gravity of the, you know, if it's an insult or, you know, if it's one of those weird conversations with an in-law who has really misplaced opinions on how to fix this.
Sure.
If it's just a street encounter with a racist, I guess I'd probably just yell, you know, F you. You've come up with something that's equivalent of a punch in the face, I guess.
You have to be careful, though, right? Because you don't want to become physically hurt yourself. You're right.
Yeah,
there are different situations and different solutions to each. But listen, it was a pleasure having you on with us. Thank you so much for sharing the perspective.
Absolutely.
And we expect, actually, we have our next guest waiting in the wings. But again, I do want to thank you for joining us, Anne. Great to have you with us. Take care.
Yeah. Bye.
Okay. On to Major League Baseball now. Quite a segue. But as the MLB tries to salvage its 2020 season, Most teams are now working away from the diamond to try to help researchers slam a home run in a major new effort to defeat COVID-19. 27 teams, including the Phillies, are taking part in a massive study to determine how deeply the coronavirus has infiltrated various parts of the country. Thousands of people will be tested to try to detect COVID-19 antibodies, part of an effort to eventually reopen sections of the economy. The study is being conducted by the Sports Medicine Research and Testing Laboratory in conjunction with Stanford University and USC. And joining us now with the particulars is Daniel Eichner, president of the Sports Medicine Research and Testing Laboratory. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks very much for having me. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Been busy, but it's all good work.
I'm sure you are busy. So Daniel, this is it's a nationwide study involving as many, I think it's 10,000 people. And again, the test is used to detect COVID-19 antibodies. Remind us of how antibodies work in the body and what the testing might reveal.
Sure. So there's a couple of ways you can test for COVID-19. In the clinical diagnostic testing, they do a PCR test, which measures exactly the virus in the body. And that's how you can diagnose if you have COVID-19. We are not doing that. We're doing a more indirect way to test for someone who may have been exposed to COVID-19 by testing for the antibodies. And so you generate an immune response when you get infected by a virus, and we're measuring that immune response for this prevalent study. So the advantage on this kind of antibody testing is that if you've been exposed to the virus and you didn't know it, you had no symptoms, you didn't go in for testing, then the antibody test still may reveal that you've been exposed, and that will give us a better indication of what the true prevalence of COVID-19 infection is in the nation.
Can the test determine whether a person who had been infected is immune to COVID-19?
You know, we're not quite there yet. There is a lot needs to be understood on the immunity. If you look at other viral infections, you do get immunity for a period of time after you're infected and you have generated antibodies, but we're too early on with this COVID-19 infection to really understand what that immunity looks like, how long it lasts for, whether you can be infected again. The information just isn't known yet.
Okay, and it's important also to distinguish that testing for antibodies from testing for an actual coronavirus infection, correct?
Exactly. So we're not testing for the coronavirus. We're testing for that immune response, the antibody response to that infection. So it is different. It's a non-diagnostic method, but it's very good for prevalent studies.
Why recruit Major League Baseball?
Well, to be perfectly honest, we saw a gap in the information of what the true prevalence was in the nation, and to do a nationwide study as quickly as we could. We had done some great work with MLB on other research before, and we went to them because they had nationwide coverage and they could, you know, they'd shown in the past that they dedicated to research, and we went to them and asked if they would help be willing to partner with us on this nationwide study, and they didn't hesitate at all. And, you know, it's pretty much every single team wanted to help out in some way they could. They wanted a chance to give back, and importantly, they all did this for no publicity. I mean, we've been working on this for weeks before anyone knew about it, because MLB really just wanted to do this as a public health initiative.
Okay, so some were speculating that Major League Baseball might have been involved because it could help position the league for a quicker approval to open up from health officials. That's not the case?
Couldn't be further from the truth. You know, if you have a look how long the study has been taken, you know, to initiate, or from planning, procuring kits and experts in the field, I mean, it took many weeks. The only reason why anyone really heard about this was when the testing actually started happening in the field for real. The only reason why MLB partnered with us on this one is to get a better understanding on what the true prevalence was on COVID-19 throughout the nation, to help drive public health policy decisions. That's the only reason why they were involved in it, and that's the only reason why we were involved in it. MLB was just a perfect catalyst for us because they had nationwide coverage. That's the only reason why they were involved.
Okay. Well, so tell us a little bit more, Daniel, about how data from this study will drive public health policy or help drive policy.
Sure. So, I mean, if we have a look at the current numbers that are reported, these are people who generally have had symptoms, gone into the healthcare system and been tested for the diagnostic method, the PCR method that directly measures the virus. And so they're the numbers that are getting quoted throughout the nation. And they're very important. but that doesn't give us a true indication of how many people may also be infected. So if you have, you know, a certain percentage of the population that has been infected without having any symptoms, these people could still just be passing the virus on to people without even knowing, because they've had no symptoms. And if we have a significantly high percentage of the population that has already been exposed to COVID-19 and has recovered and has antibodies, well, we might be able to start opening up the economy and workplaces a lot more quickly if that's the case.
So as far as the MLB is concerned, a number of players will be involved, but also people associated with Major League Baseball from the top on down?
Well, that's exactly right. So this is not an athlete study by any means. Most of the samples that we've analyzed are from the team employees. And again, these are all the way from the team owners down to people selling hot dogs and beers at the stadiums and everything in between. The large majority of the sample population is absolutely workers. We're trying to get a general view of the population as opposed to honing specifically in on an elite athlete or young elite athlete population.
Will MLB families be tested as well?
So all the testing has actually taken place. It went through a two-day period last week, so all the testing has been done.
Okay.
All that collation and analyzing and interrogating the data at this moment, all the testing has taken place. And yes, there were spouses involved in some of the programs as well, depending on the teams.
And just this note, the Phillies offer the testing opportunity to members of the front office. We don't know of any Phillies players who were involved. So let's get back to the actual testing procedure. I know you said the testing's been finished. When somebody received the test, how did they handle it? What happened from there?
So each individual team received a certain number of these point-of-care test kits. And we went with the point-of-care testing kits just because it was much easier in the environment now. People wouldn't have to go to the hospital or get a nurse to come in and do phlebotomy and then ship the samples to the laboratory. So we use a point-of-care device just because it's going to be much easier for this kind of study. Each individual team physician would be in charge of their own program, and some of the teams would do drive-through programs. Some of them would have big areas where they could come in for testing so there wasn't any social gathering. And some other initiatives from those team physicians as well. But they would oversee their own team testing program that way. And then we had a secure database that the team physician would then be responsible for, to getting all the data.
So what did it involve? A prick on the finger? Or what did the actual testing involve?
I've kind of glossed over that. So the point-of-care device is a very simple device. It's literally a finger prick. You need a little bit of blood from your finger. You drop it in this little device, and it almost looks like a pregnancy test kit. So, I mean, it's something that's very small and easy to operate. You put a couple of drops of blood in the device, some buffer that goes in there, and then you get a result just in a few minutes. So you can actually visually see it very quickly. The team physicians that would then be responsible for imaging that result and uploading it into a secure database. Importantly, all de-identified, so we have no idea as researchers who the individuals were.
Okay, so and obviously, Daniel Lechner, the effort to squash this pandemic is a race against time. It's a massive study. When do you expect to have results?
We're very close. I mean, we've done nothing else. We've been full-time on this with our great collaborators at Stanford and USC, and we hope to have the results out this week.
So it's what, 24/7 in the lab then right now?
I've got to confess, I'm social isolating myself, so I'm doing most of my work from home right now because, you know, the point-of-care devices didn't entail us having to do the analysis at the lab, but we're working as much as we can to get this out. And, you know, there's a lot of great people that have collaborated through the commissioner's office. All the individual teams were fantastic. And then again, our great collaborators at Stanford and USC have been working overtime to get this important data out.
How's it being financed?
We were fortunate to get some funding, at least for the purchase of the kits, but all the hard work that's been done by everyone involved has all been pro bono. So, I mean, this study would cost an enormous amount of money and a huge amount of time to prepare through other channels. But with the great partnership that we've had with MLB, the individual teams, Stanford and USC, we've kept the costs significantly down and really moved this forward faster than any other program that this size could really be done.
And you expect when you get this actual data, the results in hand, that they might contribute heavily to decisions made to possibly reopening parts of the economy?
Absolutely. I mean, without knowing the true prevalence of the COVID-19 infection, all we're doing is guessing on whether it's a good time to go back to work or not. Having some hard data to make the decisions is absolutely crucial.
We are speaking with Daniel Eichner, president of the Sports Medicine Research and Testing Laboratory. It must be noted that Dr. Anthony Fauci is a huge fan of the world champion Washington Nationals. And he said last week that there might be a way to get pro sports up and running again. And I'm just kind of asking for some insight from you here. He says no fans at the stadium, ball players, sequestered in big hotels, players tested every week for COVID. Care to weigh in on this thought? I mean, it's not just MLB, it's the NBA, obviously, and the NHL. You know, there are billions of dollars at stake here, and obviously the leagues are anxious to get things going again.
Well, to be brutally honest, you know, I love my kids more than anything in the world, but I need to go back to work. I think a lot of people in the nation feel the same way, that they want to get back to work.
Yeah.
Sport is absolutely integral in society. It's an important area. It's an important workplace area as well. And so sport, as much as everybody else, wants to get back to work. These data that come out of this study will absolutely help drive public health policy to get people back to work. And sport will absolutely be included in that program as well.
Okay. Dan, no one knows for sure, of course, when life will actually return to anything resembling normal. Researchers at Harvard are now saying if a vaccine isn't developed relatively quickly, we're potentially looking at intermittent social distancing practices until 2022. You have a doctorate in viral immunology, correct?
Your
thoughts here?
Yeah, I think it's, again, too early to really predict on how long this is going to last. I don't think we're going to be back to any kind of normalcy in the next couple of weeks, that is for sure. But really, depending on how the data looks, I mean, if the true prevalence was extremely high, and, you know, most of the population had already been infected, that changes things a lot. You know, if the infection rate isn't really that high, well, then we're probably stuck in this kind of situation for a long time until a vaccine is generated. There is a lot of information that really needs to be known, and I know there's a lot of fantastic researchers out there dedicating full time to this area of knowledge, but we really need to get more data before we can start making those predictions properly.
Yeah. Well, predictions aside, when it actually comes to reopening a business, if the virus is in the community, as somebody, you know, with your background, with your doctorate, I mean, what are good rules of thumb for having an open business anyway? For instance, in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, you know, patrons must wear masks going into businesses. There must be social distancing practices. What do you think, and again, this is kind of an out of left field question, if you will, businesses need to consider as they approach reopening?
Sure. And I mean, you know, people who have gone through the antibody testing, if they don't have any antibodies, you know, I think that indicates that what they've been doing has been working, which is great. The bad news is they've got to keep doing what they've been doing. And so if they've been social isolating, and they've been, you know, making, you know, very essential trips every now and then, wearing gloves and masks, then they should really keep doing that. I personally am doing that right now. I think that until more is known about this, we'd be kind of, I think it'd be premature to start taking away the gloves and masks right now. So I think they're a fine idea. I'm also a full believer in supporting the local community. So if we can still get our takeout menus from our favorite restaurants to keep them going and pay our cleaners who even aren't cleaning, all that kind of stuff, I'm a full advocate for that kind of stuff, but I still think that we're in a position now where we can't really start loosening too much until we know more.
All right, Daniel Eichner, pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Have a great day. Cheers.
You too. Daniel Eichner is president of the Sports Medicine Research and Testing Laboratory. And as always, we invite you to join us on social media here at Radio Times. Just head to whyy.org. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thank you so much for joining us, and be well.